I felt that one of the best ways to honor and respect those of us, those men and women who have served, and many who have died in support of this country, was to read some of their actual words written during times of war. The first letters we read will come from the Civil War. Sullivan Blue was a lawyer, politician, and Union officer from Rhode Island when he wrote to his wife, Sarah. The second letter is written by Union Private J.O. Smith at the Rowlett Farm Field Hospital during the Battle of Antietam.
Sullivan Ballou, July 14, 1861, Camp Clark, Washington. My very dear Sarah, the indications are very strong that we shall move again in a few days, perhaps tomorrow. Lest I should not be able to write again, I feel impelled to write a few lines that may fall under your eyes when I shall be no more. I have no misgivings about or lack of confidence in the cause in which I am engaged, and my courage does not halt or falter. I know how strongly American civilization now leans on the triumph of the government, and how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and sufferings of the revolution. And I am willing, perfectly willing, to lay down all my joys in this life to help maintain this government and to pay that debt. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence could break. And yet my love of country comes over me like a strong wind and bears me unresistibly on with all these chains to the battlefield. The memories of the blissful moments I've spent with you come creeping over me, and I feel most gratified to God and to you that I have enjoyed them for so long. And hard it is for me to give them up and burn to ashes the hopes of future years, when God willing, we might still have lived and loved together and seen our sons grow to honorable manhood around us. I have, I know, but few and small claims upon divine providence, but something whispers to me, perhaps it's the wafted prayer of my little Edgar, that I shall return to my loved ones unharmed. If I do not, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I love you. And when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Forgive my many faults and the many pains I have caused you, how thoughtless and foolish I have oftentimes been. How gladly I would wash out with my tears every little spot upon your happiness. But, oh Sarah, if the dead can come back to this earth and flit unseen among those they loved, I shall always be near you, in the gladdest days and in the darkest nights, always. Always. And if there be a soft breeze on your cheek, it shall be my breath. As the cool air fans your throbbing temple, it shall be my spirit passing by. Sarah, do not mourn me dead. Think I am gone and wait for thee, for we shall meet again. Sullivan Ballou was killed a week later at the First Battle of Bull Run, July 21st, 1861. From J.O. Smith, the Rowlett Farm Field Hospital. A strong, sturdy-looking Reb was coming laboriously on with a Yank of no strong, small proportions perched on his shoulders. Wonderingly, I have joined the group surrounding and accompanying them at every step. And then I learned why all this is special demonstration, why the Union soldiers cheered and cheered again this Confederate soldier. Not because of the fact alone that he had brought into the hospital a sorely wounded federal soldier, who must have died from hemorrhage had he been left on the field, but from the fact that the Confederate too was wounded. He was totally blind. A Yankee bullet had passed directly across and destroyed both eyes, and the light for him had gone out forever. But he marched on with his brother in misery, perched on his sturdy shoulders. He would accept no assistance until his partner announced to him that they had reached their goal, the field hospital. It appears that they lay close together on the field, and after the roar of battle had been succeeded by that painfully intense silence that hangs over a hotly contested battlefield where the issue is yet in doubt and where a single rifle shot on the skirmish line falls on your ear like the crack of 1,000 cannon, the groans the wounded Yank reached the alert ears of his sightless Confederate neighbor, who called to him, asking him the nature and extent of his wounds. On learning the serious nature of them, he said, "Now, Yank, I can't see or I'd get out of here mighty lively. Some darn Yank has shot away my eyes, but I feel as strong otherwise as ever. If you think you can get on my back and do the seeing, I will do the walking, and we'll sail into some hospital where we can both receive surgical treatment." Well, this program has been followed, and with complete success, we assisted the Yank to alight from his rebel war horse, and you can rest assured that loud and imperative call was made for the surgeons to give not only the Yank, but his noble Confederate partner immediate and careful attention.
A second set of Civil War letters comes from people close to home. These were written by the Wilson brothers, Lester and Davis. Lester later moved to Bozeman and was the father of Fred Wilson, the architect who defined the look of many Bozeman homes and other buildings. The first was written from Lester to Davis. Davis was at Oberlin College and Lester was stationed in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. The second is from Lester to Davis, now with the Army of the James, as was written in Savannah, December 1864, at the conclusion of Sherman's march to the sea.
Headquarters, 60th New York, Murfreesboro, Tennessee, October 8th, 1863. Dear brother, yours of the 28th was received this evening and the first mail for nearly 2 weeks. I was not so surprised to learn that you were in Ohio. I think that you may be a little surprised to learn that I am in the West. I would like to write you a long letter about the journey, but I have no time. Suffice to say, I know by experience that you were in a proud old state. The people of Ohio met us at every station and cheered us on like none other but New York people know how, and it seemed that we were at home. Young ladies gave us refreshments. Nothing was allowed to be sold to the soldiers passing through the state. Well, enough of this for this time. We are in Secessia again, and things look the same as in the army we have left. I suppose our destination is further on, but on the day before we got here, the rebels made a raid and burned a bridge and tore up the tracks, and we were obliged to disembark. I think we will go on tomorrow. We arrived here day before yesterday, and we will go on to the front presently, as rumored, to guard the railroad 30 miles from here. We were on the cars for about 16 days, and with such accommodations as we got, I can assure you, it was no easy job. Our horses have not come up. I am glad you like your school so well. And with all, you have become a military man. I would like to see you drill. You say that you've learned the duties of an adjunct, and I think you will see the numbers and I think if you could see the numbers and reports on my desk yet to be made out, you would think of something to learn yet. Our moving at this time makes a great deal of work for me, as it was last month and the end of the quarter. But no more of this at this time. We will get straightened out. We'll write again. I am in good health, but a little tired. Write soon. In haste, yours truly, Lester Wilson. Headquarters, 3rd Brigade, 2nd Division, Savannah, Georgia, December 17th, 1864. Dear brother, yours of the 19th was received. This day, the first mail we have received, and it will be the first time we have been in the light of day for a long time. You have also been in the dark somewhat as regards our forward movement, but have become fully posted, and therefore I will not dwell on the particulars. We've marched through the state, stole a great deal, lived well, and have come out safe at this point. But the easiest thing in the world is to get shot here. We are in line on the Savannah River, about 3 miles from the city, and about 200 yards from the rebel woods. There is a continual fusillade kept up, and of course we have casualties. Billy is now fully engaged in finally establishing the cracker line, and when that is done, look out for music. My health has been excellent during the campaign, and we've had but little fighting thus far, and yet there is hard work to do. You will have to be contented with a short letter and a meager description for the present, at least. It may be I shall be able to tell you what I presume you desire me to write in some future day. You are quite profuse in your compliments about my promotion. I can say to you that I am proud of it, but such things are matters of chance. There are many other officers in the Army more capable and more worthy than I am who have not yet been promoted. I have always attempted to do my duty, and further than that, I cannot have been ambitious. I do not ascribe my promotions to my own efforts, as I have said. I have not been mustered yet, but I am gratified to know that most of the officers and nearly all the rank and file wait anxiously for the time when I can take command. That will make things much easier if I could ever attain it. Dave, you point your life as one has been given spent in a struggle for naught. With your education and my health, how quickly I would change with you. I have a desire to study, but the prospect dims the longer I stay in the Army. I read letters from home today. It seems they are having pleasant times. It would be pleasant if we could meet there, and hope we may this winter. I will try to go home for 2 days after the campaign is ended, but I can write no more at this time. Write soon. Truly, your brother, Lester S. Wilson. And a final word on the Wilson letters. Lester to Davis Wilson, 1863. Quite a pleasant incident occurred to us while we were on our way here. In Kentucky, we met the train of rebel prisoners, and both trains were stopped sometime at the station. There we got the troops that fought at Gettysburg, and we knew the badge of the White Stars. Our boys got water and shook hands with each other, and when they came to the part, you would have thought we were the best of friends. If these men were left to settle the war, it would soon be ended.
During World War II, Lieutenant Don W. Moore, wrote to his wife Doris in Toledo, Ohio. He was stationed in England, and it was August 1943. The newly married couple was expecting a child, and the 25-year-old B-17 pilot could hardly wait. He wrote to his wife,
"It is now the 2nd of the month, and I still have received no word. I am kind of beginning to wonder a little bit."
He died that same month. And Staff Sergeant Warren Seyfried, an engineer on Don's plane, wrote to Don's wife, Doris. Seyfried was recuperating from wounds when he wrote it.
"Dear Mrs. Moore, just received your second very fine letter here at the hospital. The only reason that I can give for not answering the first letter is that I thought I would see you soon to tell you the details. Have had a short furlough since then and turned it into a honeymoon. To write what happened to Pappy Moore is a great deal harder than it would be to tell about it in person. But if you will bear with me, I shall do my best for the present. As you know, it all happened on August 27th, 1943. The time was 19:2700 hours, or 7:27 p.m. We will go back to the raid briefing to begin the story. For 3 consecutive raids, our ship was badly shot up, and we were forced to leave the formation. Persons not in such planes can't quite understand it, so the group operations officer talked to Don on this particular morning and gave him orders to stay in formation. We were scheduled to lead an element that day. It was the first step to making Lieutenant Moore a captain. At the last moment before takeoff, the deal was changed, and we were moved to our regular position at the tail end Charlie. We all felt bad about that, because that was the hot spot of a formation at the time. Everything went along just fine that day until we were on the actual bomb run. It seemed that the flak was centered on our ship. The ordinary thing to do would be to pull up or out just a little. But because of the orders that morning, Pappy decided to stay in and ride it out. First, we were hit near the ball turret, wounding Kosmicki. The next burst took the left wingtip off. Then came the bad one. It went into the bottom of the left inboard engine and burst before it came out of the top. By some miracle, none of us in the cockpit were wounded. Naturally, the wing caught fire from the last burst. We tried to put the fire out, but it was impossible. Lieutenant Moore rang the bailout bell for the crew, then gave me orders to get a chute. When I came back with his chute and watched him put it on, I was told to bail out. After waiting till he set the automatic pilot, I left. Fellas that I talked to from the crew later told me that he was still talking to the crew members and giving orders when they left. I believe that you know by now that all of the crew did get out. That is the reason that your husband is gone. He would never have left until everyone else had gone. In other words, he died so that the crew could live. I did not believe that he was dead, but the Germans showed me his watch and ring when I was in for interrogation. There were 3 of them in the remains of the plane. The wing had burnt off before they had time to get out. Something that I would like to tell you about happened later in the prison camp. As you know, we were all pretty close to each other on that crew, and it was sort of a family with Don as Pappy. I felt pretty bad about him going out, and I was telling a fellow about it. The fellow answered like this: "Red, there are 2 ways to die, to die for nothing at all, or to die for life, for thousands of lives. That is the way he went. He was that way, not just on the outside, but all the way through. He proved that the only thing that we can do is pray that he didn't go in vain, to hope that people back home keep his reason just the same. Not much else to say now, Miss Moore, except God bless both you and Douglas. And when he grows up just a little more, tell him for me that he can well be proud of the way that his daddy died. Sincerely, Warren Sifrit.
Our final letter comes from the Vietnam War. Sergeant Philip Woodall writes his father about the recent assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., comparing King's death with that of his platoon leader, an African-American lieutenant who died in battle. Woodall expresses his disillusionment with the war and his dismay about events on the home front. Following the reading of this letter, we will have a moment of silent meditation.
April 5, 1968. Dear Dad, I've just been listening to the Vietnam radio station. They just had a news report special on the assassination of Martin Luther King in Memphis. I realize how involved you are with the whole situation. I also realize how bad this makes Memphis look to the rest of the nation. I heard President Johnson's speech, but now I've got a story to tell. On Friday, March 29, in our AO just south of Hue, near the ocean, we received small arms fire from a village. My platoon leader, Gary Scott, 2nd Lieutenant Infantry, was in command. Lieutenant Scott, a Negro from Rochester, New York, graduated recently from the University of Syracuse. As the platoon moved toward the rear of the village, automatic weapons fire suddenly came from a near woodline. Lieutenant Scott and one other man were killed. He was a fine man, a good leader. Yet we could not understand the whys of this conflict, which called him 10,000 miles from his home to a land of insects, poverty, and hostility. This conflict which killed him. Why? This country is no gain that I can see, Dad. We're fighting, dying for a people who resent our being over here. The only firm reason I could find is paying with commie lives for U.S. lives, Dad. Tonight the nation mourns the death of Martin Luther King. Not me. I mourn the deaths of the real leaders for peace, the people who give the real sacrifice, people like Lieutenant Scott. Tonight, as the nation mourns Dr. King, they drink their cold beer, turn on their air conditioners, and watch their TV. We who mourn the deaths over here will set up our ambushes, pull our guard, and eat the sea rations. I will probably get a bronze star for the firefight. Lieutenant Scott will get a silver star. That will help me get a job someday and is supposed to suffice for Lieutenant Scott's life. I guess I'm bitter now, Dad. This war is all wrong. I will continue to fight, win my medals, and fight the elements and the hardships of this country. But that has become because I'm a soldier and it's my job and there are other people depending on me. That's my excuse. That's all I have. Theories and excuses, no solutions. Your loving son, Phil.